Welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, the latest on shares, markets and investments, now available on your Amazon Alexa.
Hello and welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, now also available on the UK Investor Magazine mobile app. For today's podcast, we're going to be taking a deep dive into One Health Group. It's an AIM-listed healthcare company, released a trading statement earlier on this week that we're going to be delving into. There are some pretty strong numbers in there. I'm going to be lifting the lid on those figures, as well as looking at the wider business and the growth strategy. And to do that, we're very kindly joined today by Adam Binns, who is the CEO of One Health Group, and Derek Bickerstaff, who is the chairman. Adam and Derek, welcome you to the podcast today.
Hi, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
So, as I say, it's going to be a pretty broad conversation. We're going to be looking at recent numbers that have been released to the market, and we're also going to be lifting the lid on the business. But before we get started, please would you both be able to give us an introduction, first of all, to yourselves, as well as a brief introduction to One Health Group, please.
Okay, so this is Derek Bickerstaff. I'm the chairman and founder of One Health. I'm an orthopaedic surgeon by trade. I started One Health in 2004, and then around about 2018, decided we really wanted to go for growth. And then Adam was brought on board with it, and he developed a management team to take it since then through two IPOs and, to be honest, a COVID crisis as well. So done very well.
Yes, as Derek says, I joined in 2018. My background isn't healthcare. Retail, logistics, manufacturing in big blue chips, but it's very evident when I had the interview with the board at One Health Group, there's some real potential for WARS at the time, a Sheffield-based SME, do some really impressive stuff. And I think reflecting on the past 8 years, we started a really interesting journey. And what we'll talk about today in terms of longer-term strategy is kind of the start of the next phase in the growth plan for me. But yeah, a great business.
So you mentioned there the business. I think that's going to be a sensible place to start to give listeners a really good insight into what One Health Group does, and then we're going to move on and look at some of the recent numbers. So preparing for this podcast, really interesting business model, and I think we're going to have to start here and really go into some detail about what you're doing, the opportunities that you have, and of course I think a good place to start would be, is the business model, you know, start from the top and really break it down, and then we can go and look at individual elements of the business as we go. So looking at the business model, can you please explain your revenue generation model, your relationship with the NHS, and where you sit within the ecosystem, please?
Yeah, well, One Health provides medical services to the NHS. Specifically, we provide elective orthopaedic surgery. So we provide extra elective orthopaedic capacity to deal with the waiting lists. And as you know, the waiting lists at present are about 7.2 million. So there's a huge amount of patients out there. The way we do that is through a contract which we obtained in 2012, where we can take referral directly from the GP into our company. So we hold that patient and we take the patient throughout the whole clinical care pathway back out to discharge. And that's very important for One Health. We're not subcontracted by trust hospitals or other independent sector hospitals. We, in a way, own the patient and own the contract. And the model we use is, rather than bring patients into hospitals, the big ivory tower concept, which is the big all-seeing, all-dancing hospital where patients need to be brought to, we take our surgeons back out into the community, which is consistent with the present government plans with regards to transferring care from hospital into community. So we work out of about 40 community clinics over a wide area in the north of England, in the Midlands. We take our surgeons out into the community. They see the patients for all the consultations, the diagnostics and all the rehabilitation. 40% of our referrals need surgery. And if that's the case, we then take them to local independent sector hospitals in whom we have a subcontract. We work out of 14 at the minute. We added 4 this year. Well, after surgery, then they're back out into the community for their rehabilitation and then subsequent discharge. The reason we get patients referred to us is through something called patient choice. So when you go in to see your GP, say with a hip problem, conservative measures have failed and the GP thinks that you need referral to see a surgeon, you're then referred through something called ERS, which is the electronic referral system, a bit like a Google search. So because we service so many community clinics, whenever the Google search comes up, they search on speciality. We cover those 4 specialities we talked about, which orthopaedic, spine, general, and gynae. Our clinics are always near to the GP, and our waiting times to be seen and to operate are short. So we pick up lots of patients. They're given a choice to maybe see the local NHS hospital or maybe other independent sector providers. But because we can see people quicker and more local to them, we get lots of patients referred to us.
So you talk about revenue streams. The way we are paid, we are paid for every piece of activity we carry out on an individual basis. So every consultation, every physiotherapy, every procedure has what's called a price on something called a tariff. The NHS publishes the tariff every year, aligned with the financial year. And the tariff reflects the cost of delivery for the NHS. Now, we benefit from that because our operating cost base is lower than NHS, but we're paid exactly the same. There's no premium, there's no discount. We get paid the same for each procedure. We are paid very quickly. The NHS is a very good payer. We don't have bad debt. And because we subcontract all activity, we're generally cash positive. We pay our suppliers later and receive the income. So that also reflects the fact we generate a lot of cash as a business and always have done. I think what's really important in terms of the relationship with the NHS, because we only do NHS work, we can often negotiate with a clean pair of hands. There's no distraction of private and self-pay. So the relationship with the NHS at several levels is really strong. Historically, it's always been the ICBs, which is the Integrated Care Boards, who hold the purse strings and pay for activity. Before that, they were called CCGs, but the systems, that's the same, but in reality, a different name. So the people who pay the bills are the ICBs who hold the cash. Since the pandemic, there's also been a second revenue stream, relatively small but consistent, from trusts themselves. Now, the local NHS trusts, and we operate across six in our locality, is where the real waiting list sits. The 7.2 million Derek referred to are sat within individual trusts in individual areas around England. So always the case, quarter four, we get a knock on the door, or can you help us out? We want to reduce our internal waiting lists. So the team that we employ in Sheffield, the 50 employed staff, will contact patients on the NHS waiting list, ask them through patient choice if they'd like to refer out of the NHS into One Health Group for treatment and care. And that always gives us a quarter four uplift. And it was significant this year for reasons we'll come on to explain. So I think the important point about the relationship we have with the NHS is we're seen as an integrated part of the supply chain, not a separate provider. So often the first point of call for the trust is to call us, but also the GP referrals will now become known for speed of service and quality of care in a wider and wider region. Hence the increase in both ERS referrals, their GP referrals, but also trust work is increasing directly with local trusts.
And we're going to be discussing some of that high demand and how that's translating into higher revenue for One Health a little bit later on. So you mentioned there a number of surgeries and procedures that you carry out. I think it'd be good for listeners if we could delve a little bit deeper there into the types of surgeries that you're carrying out for patients and maybe if you have any stats on the waiting between these different surgeries and procedures that one group are delivering and what that looks like. And also, if you have any information on, you know, are there certain surgeries that attract a higher fee than others, maybe?
Yeah, no problem. So I think Derek mentioned previously, we carry out four. We added one more recently, which I'll come on to, urology. So the business was formed over 20 years ago now on the basis of orthopedics and spines, general surgery and gynecology. In terms of ratios, you've probably got 80% in the first two, orthopedics and spines. And to be honest, that reflects the national waiting list. If you look at the 7.2 million, the exception of ophthalmology, the four specialists we provide represent 80% of that waiting list. So it's no coincidence that's where the strength and growth is. Talking about tariffs, it's not common knowledge, but orthopedics and spines are higher tariff procedures generally. Hip and knee replacements are around £7,000. Spines can range from £6,000 to £11,000. Then going down the chain, gynecology and general surgery are generally cheaper tariff procedures. And then I mentioned a minute ago, we introduced urology at the back end of 2025. And that was based on local NHS demand. There was a backlog of vasectomy patients in a local trust. They reached out to One Health Group for support. So very quickly, we can turn on the specialty. The model replicates very, very well. We found a couple of urologists to do the work. We found a location to do the work from. And within 2 to 3 months, we've got a new service. So 2025, when we started, right at the back end of the financial year, turnover about £20,000 or £30,000. Year just finished, there's around £350,000 of contribution for urology. So it demonstrates the scalability of the business model, not only by geography, but also by specialty. But certainly the core activity for One Health has always been orthopedic and spines. And that'll feed into what we call the Surgical Hub Programme shortly. But that's the bulk of the revenue based on high tariff, high margin procedures, but also, importantly, very high demand nationally.
Indeed, and we're going to come and discuss your new hub that you have in planning a little bit later on in the podcast. But let's now touch on the numbers that were released this week. As I said, they're particularly strong. I believe revenue for the full year of 2026 came at 32 million, beating a consensus of 29.4 million. EBITDA was also higher than expected. What was the driving force here? Was it more procedures being carried out? Was it a better mix of surgeries in terms of revenue for each one? What does that look like? What was the real key driver to higher revenue?
It's very, very simplistic. It's more of the same. I mean, the NHS demand is not being met. There's an important message here. So we talk about the 7.2 million waits. Apart from the trust transfer at the end of the year, we don't really touch that waiting list. So of that £32 million revenue last year, 95% was brand new patients that referred to One Health by the GP at the first instance, picked up by our team and managed appropriately back to good health, totally bypassing that waiting list. So when we talk about addressing the waiting list, the reality is it's not currently being addressed. It's sat in NHS trusts around the country. All or most of our activity is brand new patients, GP referrals, bypassing a waiting list. So 7.2 million needs to be addressed. So that's kind of the future workbook, if you like, in terms of pure business terms. But the growth of demand of our services increased. We've also increased our geography quite significantly. We continue to grow organically across new postcodes and new areas, moving into new ICBs, integrated care boards. And once we establish activity, because we can with our contract, we can open activity anywhere in England. We do the work on a non-contract basis. It's an obligation to pay because of the nature of our contract. We then get on radar with new ICBs and we get a new contract. And that's the way the business has always grown over 22 years, never lost a contract. So it's just a pure result of our ability to scale up, but also unmet demand. It's as simple as that.
Just looking at the numbers here again, I noticed that revenue is up 13%, whilst we're looking at procedures up about 15%, consultations up about 20%. So there's some difference in the percentages there. What does that mean in terms of, you know, the underlying business? You've touched on the mix there. Does that set you up for a stronger start for this year? Obviously, looking at the gap between consultations, 20%, revenue up 13%. What's the explanation there for slightly different numbers between those key figures and why they're not moving up in line with each other?
Yeah, that's a great observation. So well spotted on that one. So the reality of the trend of demand around the financial year of the NHS, which matches our financial year, is quarter four is always a bit of a last-minute panic. The NHS assign targets to individual trusts and ICBs, which are always year-end. They tend to get to November, December, January and think, crikey, we need to get to that target. So there's always an uplift in initial contact with patients in the last quarter. Now, that's consultations. So hence the uplift. Disproportionate increase in consultations is all about quarter four. But as you highlighted a second ago, they will feed through to procedures in the new financial year. So it's a time lag issue on that. The other point you make about surgical procedures, there has been a mixed change. You're dead right. So although there's been a 13% increase in revenue, a 15% increase in surgical procedures, there's been an increased demand, and it was on the news quite recently, on general surgery and particularly gynaecology. There's a significant unmet demand, waiting list demand, of gynaecology patients, which West Street has talked about quite publicly. So we've opened more capacity to meet demand from local trusts and ICBs to address that need. So very much meeting again local unmet demand in specific surgeries. And gynaecology, as mentioned previously, is a lower tariff procedure. So there's a mix effect there in terms of the growth of revenue versus the growth of surgical procedures. But we expect that to readdress itself because it'll return back to the normal trend when around 70 to 80% will go back to spines and orthopaedic high tariff unmet demand. So it's kind of a short-term year-end time lag issue, which brings a benefit to the quarter one of the new financial year. And without sharing any numbers specifically, we've seen a real boost in April as a direct result of the activity in quarter four, where the consultations have taken place, 40%-ish resulting procedures or operations, and we're seeing those in April and May now. So there's been a follow-through into the new financial year, which we're seeing today.
Fantastic. So a good start to the financial year. I just want to go back to urology that you mentioned at the beginning. Of course, that was a new speciality that was ended, I believe, at the end of the 2025 financial year. How much of an impact did that have in 2026 in terms of revenue contribution and anything more that you can say about that? And, you know, of course, it looks like an obvious path to growth, adding new specialities to One Health Group. Are there any others in the pipeline that you may be looking at in the near term?
Absolutely. I mean, a couple of questions there. So let's focus on urology first. You're dead right. We started that from a standing start at the end of 2025 financial year. Quite low volumes at the time, because it was right at the end of the year we started that, but thick end of 350 grand of revenue in the year that she's finished, and we can see growth going forward. The important part about urology as well is a specialty we can carry out without necessarily an operating theatre. we can carry out in clinics. So it offers a greater opportunity for margin, but also flexibility of the model. So that's a great example of how we can add a specialty to our business based on local demand. But in terms of any other demands, avoiding the big stuff like cancer, it's not that difficult to add a specialty to our business model. We find a consultant who's subcontracted, we find a location. There's already a tariff out there, pre-agreed by the NHS, so we can turn it on quite quickly based on demand. I think it's fair to say, if you look at the total waiting list of 7.2 million, we keep referring back to that, the vast majority of the activity on there is what we do today. So anything beyond that will be quite small volumes, but certainly if you get the opportunity, we would go for it and facilitate that.
Another channel of growth for One Health would be serving a greater number of patients. And I think this is going to go back to patient choice and the options that they have to choose One Health over other options. How do you go about attracting patients to actually come in and say, I want to go with One Health Group, that's the option I want to take for my procedure? Do you have any contact with patients beforehand? Are you out there marketing? What does that look like? How do you actually get people to come into your ecosystem?
Yeah, well, we do marketing, but it's always difficult marketing because if you market widely to the general population, it only hits home when they have a clinical problem that they want addressing. So it's very difficult doing that. We're not allowed by the NHS guidelines. We can't market ourselves. We can't advertise to general practitioners. So we do social media marketing, if you like, to patients to try and bring them on. So whenever we move into a new area, we'll be announcing that on our social media. A lot of it is through word of mouth as well. In addition, it's almost like we get marketing for nothing from the NHS through the ERS system. So every time you go on the ERS with a problem which we can deal with, orthopedic spine, etc., we appear on the ERS, so we have our banner there. And we provide an excellent service, really excellent service. The NHS has something called the Friends and Family Scoring System, which is used universally throughout the NHS, and we are required to report on that. And rather astoundingly, we're standing at 99.5% of friends and family. So obviously the patients that we treat, you know, they think that we're providing outstanding value, and they tell their friends. So it is difficult to market. I mean, patient choice is a statutory right that, you know, everyone has a right to make a choice. It isn't universally known. The government, to be fair to them, did an advertising campaign before Christmas on the radio and in papers, and also the ability to choose and information on choices on the NHS app as well. So there is stuff out there. It's not known universally, but it is we're finding it's steadily growing. And when we become in a location, we become embedded in the local health community, you know, we're just known. We're known by patients, we're known by GPs. And because we see people quickly, because we see our treating times, because we see people quickly, because we see them local to where they live, we're just getting increasing number of patients referred to us.
There's obvious questions about capacity and the capacity that you're at this point in time. But I will note, earlier on this year, you made quite an interesting announcement about a new hub that you've touched on in Scunthorpe. And that, of course, will increase your capacity. So, you know, two things here. Could you give us an idea of the capacity that you're running at this point in time? And what will the new hub in Scunthorpe mean in terms of capacity? And, you know, is this a sign of things to come? Are you going to be setting up more hubs to increase your capacity?
So with regards to capacity, I mean, there's two angles to this. I mean, yes, there's the angle of the new hubs. But for us, capacity, really, we talk about organic growth. So it's not capacity is endless, but we have loads more capacity to go at. We're only in the north of England and the Midlands, so we're constantly growing our geography. As we grow our geography, we open more clinics, we come across more surgeons who want to join us. So at the minute, there's, I wouldn't say limitless capacity, but there's loads more for us to work on with just our organic growth. With regards to the surgical hubs, you know, we will always continue with this organic growth, but because we work in more underprivileged areas, if you like, where there's a lot of demand, but they're financially insecure, so they can't afford private medical insurance and self-pay, we find that there are certain areas where there's low capacity provided by both the NHS and the independent sector. So across the patch, we have identified areas where if we were to build a surgical hub, we know that we would be able to bring patients from the locality through that. So we've identified our first hub, which is in Scunthorpe. We began building 7 weeks ago. We plan to open that in April of 27. Our second hub is already identified in West Yorkshire, and we're about to buy the land for that. We've got a third hub, which we're looking at developing in South Derbyshire. So we're constantly looking ahead with regards to growing these hubs. And as we grow our geography, you know, we're now down into Leicester. You know, we've got aspirations up into North Yorkshire to Teesside, across to Lancashire, across to Shropshire, across to East Anglia. We will come across more areas which are relatively underprivileged, but there's very high NHS demand. So as we grow, we will just identify these areas and we will drop a hub into place.
How are these hubs different to your existing locations?
The advantage of the surgical hub, because it's an owned and funded facility, we own that capacity and therefore we can dedicate that to the NHS. The current business model, which is the organic growth Derek referred to, hinges around 14 independent hospitals that we work with. We work with a few in the Circle Group and the Spire Group. So at the moment, we don't own that capacity. We simply fill gaps they present to us, which works really well. Make no mistake, that's where the organic growth comes from. But when we build our first surgical hub, which is now, as Derek says, 7 weeks in, 52-week build programme, so expect to be delivering activity from the 1st of April next year, we own all the surgical capacity. And in very, very simple terms, without getting into all the detail, that gives us an option to increase current surgical capacity by around 20%. What that means in numbers terms is between £6 and £9 million. And that's a, you know, kind of step change per hub. Important message there as well. We talked earlier about the higher tariff procedures, which dominate the waiting list. The only thing the hub will do is orthopedics, that being hips and knee replacements, huge unmet demand, and spinal procedures. So the whole thing is orientated around high tariff, high margin, high efficiency activity. But very importantly, we own the surgical space, so can book it as we need it. Unlike finding gaps in other, which also works, make no mistake, organic, we've grown organically year on year, double digit growth 5 years in a row, but we need some more capacity in these areas, Derek described, where there's no current supply, NHS or independent sector, to kind of turbocharge local surgical supply. So it's a fascinating concept and we're really excited about it, but this will be the first of many. As Derek says, next two locations highlighted, and we've got four or five beyond that, where we'll target a location subject to be able to fund and grow. But again, back to cash generation we talked about at the outset. These surgical hubs, are even on £6 million base case, will generate £1.5 million EBITDA and a lot of cash with that. At £9 million, which is kind of the top end of volume through it, it's going to be chucking in £2.5 million of EBITDA on cash. So not far down the line, you can see kind of a self-funding model, whereby the next hub's funded by the previous two. And certainly, if we can find the sites and we can find the funding through cash, we'll be building more than one at a time. But ideally, one a year is the current aspiration.
Very exciting. Of course, you know, as you say, you're very much in the north of England at the moment, so that leaves pretty much the entire south of England as an opportunity for the future. Just a very quick question, one that I have, and I'm sure some listeners may have. Could this be replicated and applied to Scotland and Wales, or is the system different there?
I mean, healthcare is devolved to Wales, Northern Ireland and Scotland. And the fundamental difference in the model is that we haven't got this contract where we, and they haven't got ERS. So patient choice doesn't apply in those areas. Having said that, the fundamental concept of One Health, this sort of hub and spoke working in the community, using spare capacity, using surgeons who have more capacity to give, that model works. So the base model works. It's how you can contract on top of that. So we will be approaching Wales and Scotland, to be honest, but at the minute, you know, England has a huge problem. It's a hugely bigger area. Population is far bigger. So whilst there's plenty of, if you like, low-hanging fruit in England, we'll work that before beginning negotiations with the devolved principalities.
And another announcement which caught my eye was one of, or two actually, of your largest commissioners switched their contracts to 5-year contracts from 1 year, I understand, which is quite interesting. What does that mean for One Health as a company? And maybe to add some context, and how long have you been working with these commissioners for, and why do you think now is the time they've switched to 5 years?
Well, to be fair, the change to 5 was at a request of One Health Group, and I'll explain the context behind that. So I joined from, I mentioned, a number of blue chip businesses before I joined, and the idea of a concept of 1 year contract that's worth £6 to £7 million made no sense at all. So we simply asked the question. So we talked to the two biggest providers, as you appreciate, we're a Sheffield-based business, so South Yorkshire, and also Lincolnshire, another very significant volume, which is where the hub's going to be, incidentally. Another significant customer said, why do we have this weird one-year annual renewal process on a contract of that size, when in reality, all we do is a load of admin, which takes 2 to 3 months, sign it again and start again. So we simply said, can we move to 3 to 5 years? Delighted, they both agreed to 5 years, and that became the norm then. So I think there's two things there. One, it's a demonstration of the importance and integration of One Health as a provider for the NHS. There's no challenge around a five-year contract, but also gives us surety. Although there's no fixed guarantees of revenue, there's indicative activity plans embedded. It gives us surety around investment as well into surgical hubs. We can see activity 5 years out. We know we've got activity. We can fund profit and cash to buy the next hub or to develop the next hub. But I think importantly as well, that model is replicatable. So we did the five-year contracts 2 years ago, and we added another one to it this year, aligned with the five, leaving using the balance of three. So today, just over 80% of all our revenue, that £32 million we've achieved in 2026, is now on five-year contracts. So it's a demonstration of the importance, the integrity, but more importantly, we are absolutely integrated with the NHS. It's seen as part of the supply chain.
Indeed. And of course, those longer contracts give you really good revenue visibility into the future. One thing that I found very refreshing for a company listed on AIM, very much in the growth phases still, is that you also pay a dividend. What's your dividend policy?
We listed originally on ACUS in November 22 and then moved to AIM last March, March 25. So we've always paid the dividend. Bear in mind, we were a fairly interesting SME based in Sheffield. Our shareholder base is very interesting, apart from Derek, obviously, who owns less now than before, sold a load at the AIM IPO. A number of our subcontracted NHS consultants who do the work for us are also shareholders. So there are 26 today. All of them bought into the business concept pre-listing, again at the IPO in ACUS, and then again at the March 25 AIM IPO. So there are 26 of the guys that do work for us that aren't employees. These are subcontracted NHS consultants. 26 of the 88 own the business as well, and attracted to not only the capital growth, which has been significant. We originally listed, bizarrely, at 6.7 million. We're now at 35 million, so significant capital growth, but also the expectation of dividends has always been there. And we're not cash constrained whereby we can't pay dividends. We've always created a lot of cash, but at the same time, we're able to build and construct surgical hubs through a combination of the equity raise in the AIM IPO, but the other cash means we can start building hubs as well. So there's no cash constraints in the business at all at the moment. So we've just done our five-year cash forecast to reflect the completion of the surgical hub in Scunthorpe, the payment of two dividends a year for the foreseeable future for the next 5 years, and also the purchase of the second site in Bradford, which will be the second site for hub development. And we've still got a very comfortable £1 million of working capital without external funding. So we're not concerned by cash. We can do both at the same time.
To finish off now, investors that may be looking at One Health Group, what would you point them towards as things to keep an eye out for in the year ahead?
Well, clearly the biggie at the moment is the surgical hub. We'd start to build. It's a one-year build. So the next significant key announcement will be the completion of the hub and starting the work. And again, down to the nature of the business model, because we can see patients well in advance of needing surgery, we can pre-book surgical activity into the hub before it opens. So it's not a case of opening the front doors and see how long it takes to fill it. It'll be full from day one. Will control the demand and the supply, quite simply. So obviously surgical hubs, we expect to buy the second piece of land within the next, certainly 7 to 8 months, a deposit on it next month, potentially. And then it's about where we go next for the next one. We've got a very ambitious growth cycle plan. It's just making that happen now. So,
and in addition, I mean, we're talking about the surgical hubs, but we still mustn't forget the base of our business is the organic growth through our increasing geography. So what we'd like people to look out for over the next year is, again, demonstrating double-digit organic growth, replicating what we've done for the previous 5 years. So it's going to be a combination of the continued base organic growth and then supplement that with the additional increase in capacity that we can offer, which increases revenue and profitability with the hubs. So it really is a combination of the two. They both really do go hand in hand.
Just a note to listeners, if you'd like to know a little bit more about One Health Group, do check out their recent trading statement. Definitely worth looking at and going through the numbers there. And also, I think there's an investor presentation available on the website, so do check that out. Adam and Derek, thank you very much for being with us today.
Lovely. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your time.
And thank you very much to everyone for listening. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed listening to the UK Investor Magazine podcast. Please do share the podcast, and we really value any reviews and comments you leave us in your chosen podcast player.
The views presented by the hosts and guests of the UK Investor Magazine podcast are in no way investment advice, and please remember, all investment involves risk.